from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on this morning's Forum program, President Barack Obama launched the Young African Leaders Washington Fellowship last year to, quote, give thousands of promising young Africans the opportunity to come to the United States and develop their skills at some of our best colleges and universities, end of quote. 50,000 people applied for 500 slots in intensive summer programs at universities nationwide. We'll check in with some of the fellows studying civic leadership at UC Berkeley's Goldman School for Public Policy, and we'll discuss the important work they're doing back home and their visions for the future of their countries. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. President Barack Obama's Young African Leaders Initiative, a new program which began last June, was set up to build partnerships with the next generation of leaders on the African continent. By bringing young African leaders between the ages of 18 to 35 to some of the best universities in the United States to learn and then return to their home countries. Out of roughly 50,000 applicants, 500 from business, civil leadership, and public management were chosen from different African nations. They will meet later this summer for a town hall meeting with President Obama. A number of them are here with us this morning, and we want to welcome them. And let me tell you who is joining us in studio for the hour. I want to welcome first Elaine Matonguiza Vari. She is an attorney from Zimbabwe, a part of the Zimbabwe Human Rights NGO Forum, and again, part of the Young African Leaders Washington Fellow Program at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
Glad to have you with us, and also glad to have Chundung Ashley Dauda, who is a peace builder, Women Without Walls Initiative in northern Nigeria, and again, part of the Young African Leaders Washington Fellowship Program at the Goldman School of Public Policy. Welcome.
Thanks, Michael.
We also have Zanawat Tanra with us this morning, co-director of the Bouake Caravan of Nonviolence, which brings campaigns of nonviolence to public schools in Cote d'Ivoire, what we still call the Ivory Coast. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We are glad to have you. We're also glad to have Sabwan El Omemkize, who is chief of the Utakela House of Traditional Leaders, and again is with the Goldman Public Policy as part of this Young African Leaders Fellowship.
Thank you for having me, Michael. Thank you.
Glad to have you, and I hope I didn't butcher too many names here. In fact, speaking of butchering names, I think I've got this one right. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who is an author of books like Half of the Yellow Sun and Americana, writes in the Washington Post, of course, American media do not say Malawi, where she's from. They just say Africa. I realized that I was African when I came to the United States. Whenever Africa came up in my college classes, everyone turned to me. It didn't matter whether the subject was Namibia or Egypt. I was expected to know and to explain. Has this been somewhat of a phenomenon for all of you so far?
Yeah.
somewhat, kind of, because we've been at the University of Berkeley. We've been meeting students. We've been meeting faculty during our lectures, during even our free periods. There's something like that almost, but not so much. And Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is from Nigeria. I had to take that away from you, Chundung, because
yeah,
I've been reading her books and I love her literature.
Oh, she's not from Malawi.
No.
Oh, okay,
she's
thank
not.
You for
she's
that.
She's Nigerian.
Well, that, by the way, was Elaine Matonguiza Vari. And what about your impressions? I love to hear. I used to do lectures to the Fulbright scholars, and there were Africans who came here. They were mainly teachers, and always be fascinating to hear, because from different nations like all of you, what your impressions are, especially being in a place like Berkeley, which is, you know, like being in a different cosmic universe in many respects. Would you get an impact of that feeling that I'm really experiencing something so unusual and so maybe even alien from what I've experienced growing up in a different continent and different country?
I have to say that when I found out that I was coming to UC Berkeley as part of the YALI program, I wasn't exactly thrilled, because the few times that I've been to the States, well, the one other time that I've been to the States, I was in Philadelphia. That's on the East. And I loved it. I loved the East. I had this impression of California from television.
You know what W.C. Fields said about Philadphia, though?
What
rather be
say?
In Philadelphia.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I agree with him. So
when he died.
Oh, he said that when he died. All right, fine. But I come to UC Berkeley. I had this impression that it would be hot. It would be the desert and sand. So I packed all my summer dresses. And I come. It's a Mediterranean climate. And I had to do some adjusting. But I'm finding that I love Cal. I love Berkeley. I love the culture. And I could get used to it. But I also want to be going back home. Yeah, I also look forward to that.
Nostalgic and lonesome for home, of course, and probably true for all the rest of you. But what about just your observations about American life? Give me a top of the head. What do you think of Chandung, Ashley Dauda?
My experience is I've read about UCB from novels and everything, where it's been ranked as one of the best universities in the whole world. And when I was like, I'm coming to UC Berkeley, oh my God, that must be something really. And my experience so far has been really, really great, especially the sessions with the professors in class. The classes have been really, really interactive, and it's totally different from what I'm used to back at home. So it's like you form this kind of relationship with your professors. Back at home, you kind of revel your professors. They're like kind of some mini gods and all that, but here you form this strong bond with them, like people like Professor Glazer, Professor Jack Edelson, Dean Brady. They're like our friends, but back at home it's like there's this kind of distance. You kind of there's a limit, but here it's really a very good relationship, which really helps you to kind of adapt and really get what they're trying to teach you. You can bring anything, any concerns you have, you can lay it on the table, and they're willing and ready to listen to you.
So there's more access to the professors. There's a better kind of feeling in the academy, I mean, in the university. And you're all, I'm assuming this is true also for you, Zana Kutara.
Zana Watara?
Yeah.
Well, I would say
you're excited about the academic life.
Yeah, really, I'm quite excited about it. And let's say my first experience was in 2012 when I was elected for a similar program, and it was in New York State. The program was hosted by SUNY Plattsburgh, State University of New York. And my first time in the U.S., I would say it was thrilling, because I was meeting new people, people with a different way of seeing Africans. And we heard that lot of stories about racism in the USA. So I went like, wow, what am I going to experience in the US? Because I had to spend the whole month there. And when I arrived, I realized the people in America are nice, no matter how individualistic they may appear. But when you get closer to them, you know they are
friendly. Do appear materialistic,
and
though.
Coming here for the second time, I was not thrilled. But when I read, when I received the mail that I was posted at UC Berkeley, I Googled UC Berkeley, and really I found out it was quite extraordinary. That's a treat being posted in a high-ranking university in the U.S., that's really great. And when I came, I met all those professors she's been citing, and I met Professor Suda. I said, wow, is this woman really a professor? Because in my country, I attend university, and university teachers, university professors are just like gods. When you see them, you have to bow to greet them. And then Suda is just like open to everybody. She's friendly, and then it's amazing.
I can tell you, speaking as a professor, we are not gods in this country by any stretch. Sometimes just the antithesis of that.
Share.
I'm going to, by the way, you're in California now, so I'm going to take the liberty of just calling you by your first names, if you'll permit me to do that. It'll make things much easier.
Yeah.
And Chief, I can just call you Chief, right?
I think it's better. That's what everybody calls me. Michael, I think for me, the Coleman School, of Public Policy at UC Berkeley, I don't think you need to get anybody else to tell you that it's the best in the country. You can just feel it. The amount of work that we're doing. I mean, I was out in Berkeley on Sunday with an NGO from South Africa, and they took out a map of Africa, and we were just chatting. And then within probably 2 minutes of it, I could actually break down literally regional conflicts and all the stuff that we've been learning in class. Mm-hmm. I could break down all the issues and regions and countries. And it was so amazing because you're sitting there, and we've been here for about 2 weeks, and the amount of stuff and the amount of knowledge that we've picked up from each other It's just amazing.
I think it's amazing that you're all so enthusiastic. And I know the Goldman School of Public Policy probably listening, UC Berkeley also listening and very happy to hear this kind of enthusiasm. Let me talk about each of your stories. So, in chief, let me begin with you. You come from a province in South Africa known as the Garden Province. And from what I understand, it's Zulu. Yes. Your title of chief, in fact, comes through inheritance. But you have a whole different life. You were a trader and an investment banker living in London and so forth. Tell us just about the leadership role that you have now. I mean, you're talking about how many people in your province?
In my province, it's about 10.5 million people. So a province for us is like a state here.
And what does it mean to be chief of those 10?
Basically, it's basically a big province. And then I've got a village or a community which has about 23,000 people. Now, most of those, the area that I'm living in is highly, highly rural. No employment, there's, you know, no water, et cetera, et cetera. So coming there, because I didn't even grow up in the area, it was a paradigm shift. You know, you walk in the walls of the city of London and the Sandtons of or the Johannesburgs of South Africa, and you in your three-piece suits every day. And then one day you have to basically take that off and roll up your sleeves and go to places where there's not even network on your cell phone. And having to try and link up that community and that economy to the main economy within South Africa. So the leadership roles, mostly for me, it has been about trying to understand the way of life, which I have because I've been doing it for about 5 years. But most importantly, trying to lead the people by basically from coming from behind. So you let the elders somehow guide you, but somehow you need to also enforce some of the leadership and some of the development that happens in the village.
Well, a couple of the things that I know are quite important to you, and this education will help you, in addition to finding ways to write for grants, for example, and get more money for the impoverished areas that you're talking about. You're interested particularly in early childhood and, interestingly enough, in women's rights and women's power.
Yeah. Crazy enough, I mean, you know, for a man to come and say, you know, they're interested in women's rights, I've seen how the shift is in South Africa. I think we are one country in Africa that literally has pushed for women's rights, particularly in parliament. You see the representation, it's basically 50% women that are there. Even in my own traditional council, out of 30 of us, 16 of them are women. And you see women actually taking up, you know, certain roles that were mostly reserved for men. But most importantly, I think for me, Michael, it's the issue of early childhood development. I've seen, because I've been in situations whereby I've taught some of the classes, you know, as a tutor on a Saturday, one of the high schools, and you see some of the basic arithmetic problems that these kids in grade 12s will have, basic things like 7 times 10 and not knowing what the answer is and taking out a calculator. So if you can get the basic foundation within the children between the ages of 1 and 10 years old, I think, you know, it becomes much, much easier when you go forward in terms of just piling on what a child already knows. So for me, it's probably one of the most important things in developing an economy that basically had nothing.
And Zena, I can go to you on this too, because you're a high school teacher and you work with a lot of youth, particularly a nonviolence campaign in the public schools in your country. And we're talking about actually not only teaching nonviolence, but teaching about people like Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, for that matter, Gandhi. I mean, leaders who we can glean a lot of in terms of nonviolence. Yes.
Yep. Well, I think thank you for giving the floor. It's very exciting whenever I hear those names. I mean, the ancestors of nonviolence. I think it was necessary for me to start that because you might have Googled my country and you find out that civil war started in 2002. And the town where I live and work used to be the stronghold of the rebels. And then a lot of violence went on there. And the whole thing finished in 2011. And then from then, I came together with some of my colleagues. We decided to work for nonviolence in our country. Because when we look at the causes of war, we realize that it's tribalism that brought about civil war in our country. When some people start thinking that other people should not be in power.
And this again is the Ivory Coast.
Yeah, it's in Ivory Coast. And then I said we have to work on nonviolence. And let's take the examples of Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and Nelson Mandela. People who promoted nonviolence, because it happened because people from the North decided to fight for the right to have power. And then we have to take, instead of fighting, instead of picking up the weapons and stirring up a rebellion, we have to think of those people. Martin Luther King, with the civil rights movement, he never waged war. He believed in peaceful methods of family fighting for the right. And then we should have followed those examples.
You feel young people are responsive and inspired?
Yeah, our young people are really responsive, because I can tell you that this academic year we've been touring 33 schools. And really, wherever we went, we were just welcomed by crowd, by local authorities, and people really liked our program. And we are even planning to make it nationwide, because in 2015, this is just in 1 year time, general election will take place. And then we want to extend it to the whole nation.
We want to make sure you don't have the traumas that you had from the last election.
Yes. We want to make sure we don't have trouble after election.
Chung-Young, let me go to you on this. And Chung-Young, Ashley Dauda, again, is a peace builder, Women Without Walls initiative in northern Nigeria. You have this terrible split in Nigeria now, too, with Boko Haram and with the sense of Christians and Muslims. And a lot of your work, in between the north and the south, a lot of your work is to try to overcome these divisions, yes?
Yes, exactly.
Tell us about what you're doing. You're looking basically for grievances that people can actually come together and talk about and try to improve?
Yes, exactly. Those divisions have been there right before Boko Haram. In Nigeria, basically, people interact on the basis of religious or ethnic affiliations. That's what gives rise to violent conflicts. So what we try to do is to make people look beyond their religious and ethnic affiliations. I mean, whether you're a Muslim or a Christian, we're all Nigerians and we're all human beings. But the Boko Haram insurgency has kind of made it worse in that most people have this perception that Boko Haram is fighting the cause of Muslims. So as a result of that, some tend to see all Muslims as kind of sympathetic to the cause of Boko Haram. But I think it's a bit easier now that Boko Haram is also attacking Muslims. So people are beginning to realize now that there's actually a dividing line between the Islamic sect and Muslims in general.
It's like ISIS in Iraq. I mean, they want to kill all the Shia and all those they feel are infidels.
Yes,
and that's
exactly.
Certainly true. Yeah. But there's also, in your country, I mean, it's an oil-rich country, yet the people are not benefiting from that wealth. They're living impoverished, and there's terrible corruption that's pervasive, isn't there?
There is. And I would say, if you ask me as an individual, I would not totally blame the Nigerian government for the pervasive nature of corruption in the country. I think we all citizens are equally guilty because we don't hold our leaders responsible. It is our duty to keep our leaders in check and hold them accountable, but the citizen is somehow complacent and somehow laid back. And I think one of the reasons I'm here on this program, one of the things I want to take back from the Goldman School is how I can get the citizens engaged in government to be able to hold our leaders accountable and ensure that they honor their obligations.
And let me bring you, Elaine, back into the conversation here, too. I think you also want to work with making citizens more responsible, more involved, in fact, more aware of the Constitution. And that's been a particular, even going out and doing song and dance types of things, right, to bring attention to the Constitution.
Yeah, that's been my work. I've enjoyed being in the community, being in the grassroots community. I'm trained as a lawyer, and that's precedence, that's judges, that's wigs, that's robes and gowns and capital.
Not so much in the United States. No wigs and gowns.
Yeah, the Zimbabwean experience. Anyway, that would be it, you know, if it pleases this court, my lord, my lady. But with working with grassroots community, there's a lot of freedom to be creative. There's a lot of freedom to think outside the box. With my work in the constitution-making process, I think I cut my teeth in civic society in that I became and I enjoyed grassroots mobilization. The song and dance routine that you're talking about, these are the road shows. Here's what corporates used to do. They launch a new washing powder. They launch a new spread. I can't call it butter. I can't call it margarine. It's just grease that you put on your bread, cheap grease. So they get a truck. They get dancing queens. They get someone with a microphone, a radio announcer who's well-known. And you go into communities that are isolated, that are semi-literate, where someone won't pick up a pamphlet, where someone won't pick up a folder or go to a public town hall meeting. And you blare the radio, the system, the speaker, you get the ladies to dance and people crowd around and then you promote your product. My product was the Constitutional Commission is coming. They have 23 talking points. A new constitution is being written. What are your views on separation of power? What are your views on citizenship? What are your views on who should be a judge, who should not be a judge, how long the president should be in power? And this strategy worked not only in getting the crowds to come to listen. You know, some are drawn by the dancing queens, but that's all right because they're drawn, they're captivated by the message, and they go home with information that they have a role to play. But this strategy also helped in that Zimbabwe was politicized. This was after the 2008 elections, and some of these communities, you couldn't go into them with a public meeting. You couldn't go into them as a civic society organization. There was suspicion. There was also a general clampdown by the police. They could give you clearance, but no one would come for the meeting. So this strategy worked in that it was almost, well, insidious. It was almost, you wouldn't, it's very, it plays on human vanity, you know. So it worked in that it attracted people. It worked in that it was different. It worked in that it wasn't confrontational.
It was effective. And I Absolutely. Should mention, you know, you've been yeah. doing a lot of work in so many different areas, working against not only working for gender equity, working against yeah. violence, working for an anti-torture yes. Statute, which would be like the UN's anti. But you're living in a country which is under Robert Mugabe and really under his dictatorship and mm-hmm. his control. It's one of the worst inflationary economies in the world, and it's one of the most repressive dictatorships in the world, at least according to everything everybody reads here in the West.
Yeah, Zimbabwe is. And I never left. Around 1999, when I finished high school, went to college, people started leaving in droves. We had the brain drain. We had people going to South Africa, even when as recent as 2008. I don't know if it was in your province, if we came as far as your province chief in South Africa, but there were droves of people that fled, went into exile in South Africa, took up menial jobs.
And a lot of the white settlers, of course, had their land taken away
yes,
from them.
Yes, this was in 2000.
What was Rhodesia? And they just left, of course, in large
well,
numbers.
Yeah. This was in 2000 after the land program, the land well,
Mugabe's program yeah. to essentially mm-hmm. well take away land and well
and we're, yeah we're, land we're, reapportionment yeah
we're coming up on a break here. You hear the music, that means we're going to break. I want to invite listeners to join us. You may have questions about the individual countries that are represented here today: Zimbabwe, South Africa, the Ivory Coast, and Nigeria. Or you'd like to hear from some of our African listeners out there about kind of the stereotypes and things that you face as being someone from the African continent in terms of American attitudes, and just join us with this discussion about what, well, some of these young people are doing, and some of what they're doing is really amazing. And you may want to respond, and your questions or comments are welcome. You can join us right now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking to a number of young African leaders who are studying in the United States and who are not going to be part of a brain drain. They're going to bring new leadership skills that they're learning here at the UC Berkeley Goldman School of Public Policy back to their home countries. And with us in studio, Chief Zwaneloi Mkhize, who is chief of the Utebeka House of Traditional Leaders, and also Zana Uwatara, who is co-director of the Buake Caravan of Nonviolence, and Chundung Ashley Dauda, peace builder with Women Without Walls Initiative in northern Nigeria, and Elaine Matongwiza, Vari, who is an attorney and part of the Zimbabwe Human Rights NGO Forum. They're all young leaders, part of the Washington Fellowship Program at the Goldman School of Public Policy, and they're a select group of people. 50,000 people applied for these 500 slots for this intensive summer program, and as I said, they're here to learn, and they're here to learn to bring back things that can be useful within their own countries, and they can learn from you as well. In fact, sort of encourage listeners to join us with some of your thoughts and some of the things that you might want to shed light on in terms of what's useful for these young Africans to bring back to their home countries, or ask them about their experiences here in the United States or about their home countries. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you are indeed welcome. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Email address is forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. There's a listener named Dadan who says, I'd like to hear the guest's thoughts on the notion of contemporary Pan-Africanism as a political force on the continent of Africa. Does their generation have any consciousness or ambition about Pan-Africanism? And by the way, for listeners, Pan-Africanism simply means, you know, the whole continent kind of joining together with what used to be called Negritude, or the idea of unity among African people. It goes back to, in American writing, back to W.E.B. Du Bois. Yes.
Yeah. I think, let me, can I take that on?
Yeah, and I'll call you Spanello instead of Chief.
Call him Chief, we all
yeah,
do.
Everybody calls. But yeah, Michael, the Pan-Africanism, I think the beautiful thing about these forums, particularly what we at the YALIF program, is that it's bringing us as African leaders or young leaders together, because I think there are underlying problems that probably will break apart even the whole ideology of Pan-Africanism, things like issues of tribalism, ethnicity, et cetera. I was lucky enough that I've been to the U.S. before on an almost similar program. It was a United World Colleges scholarship, which basically placed me out in New Mexico. And the idea of these United World Colleges is that they put together young 17, 18-year-olds in an academic institution coming from different countries. And what you find there is that there are so many similarities within Africans, ourselves, or even Europeans and Americans, that we basically tend to just look at face value, look at somebody and this person is black or white or green, etc., and you want to divide yourself just according to those basically lines. So Pan-Africanism, particularly what we're doing now at the Goldman School and this program that President Obama initiated, is we're getting to understand our cultures. We're getting to understand the issues that are within our borders, and we can find that we can get by them and basically be united as an African continent. Because now I think almost every country that I can think of in Africa, there is somebody that I know, and I've made that friendship through this program.
Did you all feel some sense of pride when Barack Obama was elected, after all, his African ancestry? His father is from Kenya. His relatives are still, many of them, in Kenya. Did you feel that kind of connection in a Pan-African way?
We did.
Yeah, I think so.
Actually, in Nigeria, there was some sort of celebration.
Really?
We were excited.
Yeah, it was just the same in my country. We were all excited.
In the Ivory Coast,
We went to bed late, because we just wanted to hear who was winning the election. We're all really expecting President Obama to win the elections.
Yeah. I think more so his re-election in 2012 was even more significant. It wasn't that he was a one-hit wonder or a black boy who could, impress people the one time, but that he's got substance. He's got a solid support base, and
well, not so much anymore. We just word out today.
Well, he's in
the
office.
Lowest in polls of any president
in
recent history.
And at the same time, we wanted that to be, to teach a lesson to Africa. Because look, among the black, among the white, a colored person is president. Whereas in African countries, we still fight for power. We still think that people from this region, people from this ethnic group should not come in power.
People of this age.
So, again, you could use this as a unity argument as opposed to the divisiveness. Yep. And here's Ben, who writes on our website. Could you ask your guests about their impressions of African-Americans, and what is something new and interesting that they've learned? Well, let's take that first question about African-Americans. It's a broad question. What are your impressions? But anybody want to go on record here? Elaine?
Yes. African-Americans, my first impression, the few that I've met, they're salt of the earth people, trying to make an honest living. These are, of course, Americans will have their own opinions. These are there's the janitor, the lady who cleans my bathroom. There's the bathroom at at UC Berkeley. There are people who are trying to make an honest living. I haven't encountered, and I'm thankful I haven't encountered so much the videos, the rap videos type. I've met honest people who are friendly. Yeah, of course I have to engage them first, because Americans generally they're a bit insular. I have to say good morning first. This is the African way, yeah. You know. We approach people.
Yeah.
You don't just pass someone and not say hi to them.
This is true everywhere, Nigeria, South Africa, Ivory Coast.
It's an African thing.
This is a pan-African thing.
This is a pan-African thing, absolutely. The ones that I've met, I've enjoyed meeting them.
And then Ben also says, what's something new and interesting that you've learned? Well, a few we've already learned that the chief and you, Elaine, have been to the United States before, but maybe I should go, Chandang and Zana, to you. I mean, and just in terms of observing Americans, what's new?
Actually, this is my third time of...
Oh, all right. So you're all better.
But actually, one interesting thing is, for the first time I was in the United States, when people get to know that you're from Africa, they feel you're from this Stone Age civilization or something like that. You're just stepping into civilization for the first time, and
they think you're going to be what, hunting cheetahs or something like that.
Something like that. And they get this impression that you don't know how to speak English, things like that. When people address me, they are kind of wondering, how do they interact with me? Do I understand English? Don't I understand English? They're like, do you own? And I'm like, what do you want to say? Oh my God, you speak English. And
you know, this can happen. There's a famous writer you may know who lives here in the Bay Area named Amy Tan, who's Chinese. She was born in Oakland. She's an American. People talk to her like that when she goes to Idaho. Places, right? All right, let me bring our callers in, and we'll start with Raymond, who's from Nigeria. Raymond, welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. First is to say that this is a commendable initiative by Obama, giving young African leaders an opportunity to come to the U.S. and rub minds with some of their contemporaries here and learn from the teachers. My interest, secondly, has to do with the Boko Haram issue. I live in Nigeria. I'm a visiting professor on vacation in Berkeley, but right now I'm calling from Cupertino. The Boko Haram issue, an unfortunate one, is simply a neglect of our leaders about 15 years ago, you know, when children are allowed to roam the streets, cup in hands, begging for food and all of that. Well, we never knew that the political units, those politicians had an agenda, you know. They were training an army of young children that they would use eventually for political reasons. You see, when you neglect formal education, you don't allow the minds of children to be enlightened, to learn beyond the borders. What you get is what we're seeing now. And it's quite unfortunate. I just hope that more people will come on board, as some of us are doing. You know, I teach religious studies in University of Ilorin, and we operate a unique department in all of Nigerian universities where all the religions come together as academic discipline. And majors in Christian studies, for instance, learn quite a lot from Islamic studies and vice versa, and then part of indigenous religion. So the idea is to come under one umbrella and learn from each other. And that's why I used to say that God hates monotony and loves variety.
Well, Raymond, I thank you for those comments. In fact, Chandang, he's, as we say in America, speaking your kind of language here, isn't he? I mean, about that need for unity, because you as a Christian have worked with Muslims and have even tried to, again, bring the best together as much as you can, yeah?
Yes, exactly. I work a lot with Muslim and Christian youths, and I try to bring them to a table where they can reconcile their differences and understand that irrespective of being a Muslim or a Christian, we're all Nigerians. And we should be fighting for the common good of everyone, irrespective of ethnicity or religion.
That is a country, though. I mean, I think about the Igbo and the division and the war that Nigeria underwent. That's had this history of division, a tremendously violent history of divisions.
It has. And as you said earlier, you were saying that the Boko Haram has brought this division, and I told you that the division has been there even before Boko Haram. I think this division comes when a certain group in the society is being marginalized, when a certain group feels they are not properly represented in politics, they are not properly being given the resources that they are being entitled to and things like that. But when we have an inclusive government where every group feels they have something to offer, their views are being taken into account, into consideration, then I don't think any group will be clamoring for secession.
There's tribalism you mentioned before in your country, Zana, I mean in the Ivory Coast, yes. And what do you feel can be done to bring some greater harmony or to heal those divisions?
Yes, thank you. I think a lot is being done, and I am also working on the question with my caravan of nonviolence, because we work basically on this issue. We think that the current government, President Ouattara and his government, are working hard on the question. That's why they are backing up all the organizations that are working on nonviolence, that are working on reconciliation. But I think if we multiply the campaigns of sensitization all over the nation, I think we can succeed in playing down this issue of tribalism. It's very difficult because, and you Googled my country and you find out that the post-electoral war was very fierce. It was deadly, and thousands of civilians were killed after the election. The President Gbagbo, former president who lost the election, didn't want to leave office just because he didn't want someone from the north to take over.
In fact, he refused to give up the presidency.
Ouattara's forces had to house him by force. So the gap is still there. Even today, people from southern tribes kind of reject those from the north, and we are working on it.
I think
the government is working hard on it.
I must say I'm struck by your optimism. All of you really have a kind of optimistic attitude that's, I hope listeners are finding, as inspiring as I am. Let me go to some more callers here. Here's Edwin, who's somewhat critical of UC Berkeley, Edwin, or maybe very critical. What?
Well, I am. Thanks for having me, Michael. First of all, I just wanted to congratulate the students coming from Africa. I am from Kenya myself, and I came here 20 years ago to go to college, and ended up going to graduate school at Berkeley. And what I've noticed is that these things that they're saying don't exist, the racism, the condensation, all of this, it's a very welcoming place. And, you know, that increases the longer you're here and the more you learn and you begin to see the contradictions. Now, if you just, shut up and just assume nothing happens, you'll live a good life. But if you point those contradictions out, then you begin to see that kind of animosity coming from even places like Berkeley. You know, I went to school there, and all these things they're talking about, I experienced them, and I taught at the university for 2.5 years. So I while I'm very excited that they are here, I would like to tell them to keep their eyes open and to think about going to Africa. You know, that's where most of us are thinking now. Over the past few years, I've started like thinking Africa, because no one is going to help us. You know, we can get a leg up, but only Africans are going to fix those. So the more of us taking the skills we have learned here, because as long as we are here, we're always going to be in exile, even if we don't we don't come from countries that have gone through wars, because you can never really be accepted, even in places that consider themselves as liberal.
Edwin, forgive me. Why don't you go back to Kenya? You've been here for 10 years.
I've actually been here for 20 years.
Okay.
And it was because
you're part of the brain drain then.
Yes, So I believed in that, that, you know, this place was going to be fair to me. It was going to be fair. And but lately, that's been my plan. You know, I spend a lot of time in the last year. I've been to Kenya twice, you know, charting that way to go forward, you know. And, so I am making that plan to go back and make some really big strides into going to that direction.
All right. I thank you for the call. It's good to hear from you. Any of our guests want to respond?
I would thank our brother, the Kenyan, and we'll be glad you could join us in Africa to help us bring forward those ASAP. I don't mean as soon as possible, but African solutions for African
ASAP,
problems.
That's good. ASAP, yeah. So you pick up this jargon right away. I've got a listener who wants to know, what are your guests' opinions on the influence, and you kind of alluded to this a little bit, Elaine, of the current U.S. hip-hop culture's influence on youth in their own countries? That is excessive materialism, glorification of violence, the things that unfortunately have become on the negative side associated with the United States culture.
I think that...
So that
was also the television culture, hip-hop culture, movie culture was also responsible for me having these misconceptions about, you know, packing a suitcase full of short dresses and finding out that Berkeley's on the cool side, you know. it is something that we've had to deal with because now among youth culture, even in my own country, we've got...
again, in Zimbabwe.
Yes, Zimbabwe. We've got kids coming up imitating this culture, but more along the dance hall, we've got a new dance hall group, crew of kids that record... I can't play this music with
you
my mom sitting there.
You can get them to go out in your dance groups and maybe appeal even to the more youth.
No, you can't. I've looked at harnessing the power of these artists for civic causes, and I feel that I'd actually be doing myself, my work, a disservice.
People, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
While the population is young and the population, I think one of my colleagues alluded to youths being frustrated. I think it was the caller from Nigeria, actually, that governments kind of let this happen. They kind of let it fester that there's a whole lot of youths that are out of school, that are unemployed, that don't have opportunities to do anything. And you see that this culture, this rap culture, is anti-government, it's almost a response or a reaction to youths not being occupied. Well, at least from the Zimbabwean perspective, Zimbabwean point of view, where youths don't have anything to do except to churn out this hypocritical, disgusting music that's disrespectful of society, of women, of living an honest.
I wish people could see the face that you made when you said the word hypocritical.
Yeah,
hypocritical hip hop. Let me read a comment from a listener.
Yeah, my face is kind of expressive.
You are very expressive. Here's Hillary on our Facebook page who writes, I'm so enjoying hearing these voices, their excitement about what they are learning here and will take back with them to their countries. They understand better their local problems and challenges. They are a bridge between the new and the developing aspects of their countries, cities, towns, and villages. They will represent the authentic voice of their needs. My family left Berkeley for 1 year to live abroad. We lived in Senegal. It was just our own self-imposed sabbatical. It was a magical and profound year for me and my husband. We did volunteer work and our kids who speak French to continue their French education in a Senegalese French school. My husband did volunteer work at a school to resurrect their defunct OLPC network with limited resources but a source of his own knowledge and intermittent access back to fellow tech colleagues in the U.S. He was able to get things working again and train one local person to keep up the support. His biggest aha moment was realizing how much outside NGOs and companies come in to try to save the day for many African nations and then leave. People want the feel-good moment, but it ends up just falling apart because of the lack of understanding of so many local aspects by those coming in. Politics, infrastructure, water and electricity, social, religious, climate, knowledgeable engagement. I very much like the idea of this program bringing opportunities to these young leaders who will take it back to their countries and build grassroots with energy that stays. I want to go back to the Nigerian novelist who writes for The Washington Post. Elaine, you can help me with her pronunciation of her name.
Chimamanda.
Thank you. I have an Nigerian guest. she says, this brings me back to Madonna. I applaud her finding of orphanages in Malawi. I wish She had added that Africa cannot depend on aid alone, that aid is like salted peanuts. The more failed leaders got, the more they wanted. I wish she had said that she was setting up an organization to use donations as microcredit, and that this organization, by the way, would be run by locals rather than expatriate staff whose expatriate salaries raise the rent in the cities. And then she says, if I were not African, I wonder whether it would be clear to me that Africa is a place where the people do not need limp gifts of fish, but sturdy fishing rods and fair access to the pond. I wonder whether I would realize that while African nations have a failure of leadership, they also have dynamic people with agency and voices.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well said. I think we all agree, huh?
Yeah.
We'll go to another call. And this is Gabby. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling really out of curiosity. One of your people there is a young man from Bouaké in Ivory Coast. And did I understand that his last name was Ouattara?
Yep.
Yes.
Yes.
Yep.
Oui.
Well, I'm just wondering, if, you know, that is the name of the president.
Yes,
yes.
And I'm wondering whether he might have had a little edge on getting chosen for this program, being a Ouattaran.
He is the current president of Ivory Coast. I wondered the same
thing.
He's
the current president, yeah.
Is he a cousin? Is he an uncle?
Oh, no, we're not related. Relation? You know, in Africa, I have to say it, in my country particularly, you can have people from different tribes with the same last name, and this happens to be the case. We have the same we have a common last name, but we are not related. We are from different tribes with different cultures.
So you didn't get an advantage.
No, I didn't get an advantage.
That's really what she's asking.
It was just independent. I think IREX did a selection.
They had leaders.
The president doesn't even know that we're coming.
Yeah. And he replaced Lauren, is it Gbagbo?
Yeah, Gbagbo.
Gbagbo.
Gbagbo, President Gbagbo.
I've never heard the name pronounced, so I had no idea. Who's going to go on trial for murder and rape?
He's already at ICC.
Yeah.
He's at ICC.
Here's Lene, who says, this is a comment for the listeners of this program. I want to encourage everyone who's listening to go to Africa. You cannot know or understand these people in their hearts unless you have been to Africa in person. My trip to the Swahili coast in 2001 has left a deep impression on my heart, and I have a hole in my soul that only Africa can fill. I love you.
Oh, thank you.
I agree, and so more people should come to Africa with the mindset of Hillary's family, coming to do something, coming to immerse themselves in the local culture, not tourists going on safari, going to the Victoria Falls, then going to Wange, then going to some wonders in your area, Chief. But to immerse themselves in the local culture and to, you know, to become citizens of the world. That way, you know, Africa isn't just Malawi isn't, you know, part of. Do you know John Banda? He's from Malawi, you know, and I'm from Zimbabwe. I have no idea. I don't know him. Yeah, more and more Americans should do that, especially since, you know, seeing the view that, there's the view that Africans tend not to want to go back to Africa. I think you were asking Edwin why he doesn't want to go back to Kenya. Americans should probably set the example by coming to Africa. They're more than welcome.
You do hear, though, and I don't want us to be, or any of you to be defensive about this, but you hear people say, well, you know, I'd like to really experience the nature of the people in, say, Nigeria or in South Africa or in Zimbabwe, even in the Ivory Coast, but I'm afraid of the violence. And you do hear this a lot, unfortunately, because there is violence. Of course, you hear Africans who say, I'm afraid to come to the United States because of the violence, too. So we've got bridges to build here, and but we have the realities, the realities of the violence.
The realities are there, particularly in South Africa, which has got a seriously high crime rate. But I can basically say for myself that probably in the last 3 or 4 years, I've not been a victim of any crime. I don't know if that makes me incredibly fortunate or maybe it's...
Well, you're a big guy.
Not even that. You know, it's not like maybe I walk around with bodyguards or anything. But I think that you experience violence anyway. I'm saddened by the fact that I've never been to Zimbabwe and it's right next door to me. Because somehow there was this perception that was perpetuated within the media that everybody is just fighting everyone. So for me, I was telling Elaine and a countrymate who's not with us that my aim basically this year is to go to Zimbabwe because I've been to all the surrounding countries within South Africa. I've been to Ghana. I've been to some of the East Coast countries within Africa because the aim is to just go and see. And as Elaine said, to immerse yourself in the culture. And what we're trying to do here as well is immerse ourselves within American culture as well. So it's not a defense mechanism, but I think there are places that I think people can come to, particularly in metropolitan areas, and you are warned sometimes as a tourist that, guys, just be careful there, et cetera, and some of them even take you somewhere so that you are safe.
Well, this has nothing to do with the violence, but you know, I was struck in reading about the particular province that you were chief of.
Yes.
The highest rate, I believe, of HIV infection of anywhere in South Africa, which has the highest rate in all of Africa.
Yes.
It's like 39%.
Yes.
I mean, you really need people to come and help.
Definitely. I think that the main thing, again, Michael, there is I think we're doing something about it. Particularly the biggest push has been the circumcision of men, because it's actually been reported and found that there's evidence that a circumcised man, will not, there's a lower chance of transmission.
I've read that research, and the anti-circ people will take you on.
That's
we've had debates on this.
Yeah. We're not even going to go there.
Yeah, that's, not cool
that's a whole other show, of course. But what would you want to say about, we've got seconds left here, about coming to any of your countries, I mean, in terms of what you'd want people to know about coming to those countries, in terms of safety particularly, or what they would discover that would be great?
Connect with people on the ground, not reading government websites so much. Of course, the government has a duty to protect you and to warn you about hotspots, but connect with people on the ground and be someone who's, don't come all touristy. Come with an attitude of, I want to go to this place and I want to be part of this place.
And I want to learn about the people, which
yeah,
is really what
absolutely.
You're saying.
Absolutely.
Okay. On that note, thank you all so much. Congratulations for being part of this program. And I'm talking about the Washington Fellow Program, but also thank you for being a part of the Forum Program this morning. Appreciate you all being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from David Marks. Forum senior editor is Dan Zoll. Thank you for being with us. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.